All right, this is John Friary.
And Armand Elkaz.
And we're interviewing, go ahead and pronounce your name for us.
John Reiskind.
Reiskind. And then we'll spell it in so when the transcriptor, R-E-I-S-K-I-N-D. Sorry, R-E-I-S-K-I-N-D. Right. All right.
And my name is actually Jonathan, but I go by John.
All right, we're very fortunate that he's allowed us into his home this morning, a wonderful place.
Beautiful home.
And you know, you already... we're talking to Armand and know a little bit about this project, what we're doing here. So we'll go ahead and just get started.
Sure. Dive in.
Okay. Tell us about your beginnings. Where were you born?
I was born in Staten Island, New York. I say I was born and bred because I was there till I went to college. Okay. And I really enjoyed my life there. And I've been thinking since waking up today about... that I've really had a very happy life. I've had secure, my parents were a loving couple, and I have an identical twin brother, which adds a perspective to life in many ways. And we are still very close to one another, though he lives in Winston-Salem. And I grew up in a community that's part of New York City, but it only had bridges to New Jersey during my stay there, and I left when I was 18. Actually, I lived there when I was in college, I guess through college, but and then they built the Verrazano Bridge to Brooklyn, and I don't know how much it's changed, but I'm going next week to my 60th high school reunion and with my brother, which is a first because he doesn't go to these things, and it should be very interesting. But it was a really a nice community, about 150,000 people in 1950. I was born in 1940, and not very unlike Alachua County in its feel.
Let me just stop for a second. October 15, 2018 is today. I forgot to mention that. Right. That'll give us some time frame here. October 15, 2018. Sorry about that.
That's right. And so it was my father worked in Brooklyn, New York, which required that he take a bus, and then a ferry to Manhattan, and then the subway to his work. So Staten Island Ferry was a very big thing in our lives. My mother was a grade school teacher, first and second grades, and she loved to work. And we spent our summers up in the Adirondacks because my mother, being a teacher, had free time in the summer, so we could get away. And my father would come up for weekends until his annual 2 weeks vacation. And it was a very lovely time. Post-war, my first clear memories was VJ Day, which was the day victory over Japan. And I have a very clear, and I was 5 years old at the time. I probably remember some vague memories a little earlier, but that is still clear in my mind. And then the 1950s were a relatively calm period. I remember clearly taking, you know, the drills that involve us, what did they call them, where you hid under your desk you were like protected from atomic attack and that sort of thing. But it was not a period, at least in my life, of any great stress. And so it was nice growing up in Staten Island. It had a lot of the wildlife that you associate with this county as well. It just was I remember it very fondly. And then I went off to college, went to Amherst College in Massachusetts and Harvard University for my graduate work. And the first job I got was at the University of Florida, and I worked here for 36 years.
What did you do, undergraduate and in graduate work?
Biology in both. And I'm an arachnologist, which is interesting. Just it is a it means someone who studies arachnids, specifically spiders. And I it's given a great identity to me that is just part of my identities. But I was thinking of a list of identities one has, mm-hmm. you know, and among them would be arachnologist, Democrat.
Yeah.
Notice the signs driving in.
Oh, yes. Of all of them. We'll get to that in a little sure. while. So the University of Florida was a very welcoming place. My department, which was the Department of Zoology and Biological Sciences, but I was in the Zoology department, had a tradition thanks to leadership in the 1950s and 60s and to this day of a very democratic department. Departments I compare to the to kind of the regions of Rome, you know, as long as they paid taxes, Rome would let them be ruled how they will. Some are democracies, some are authoritarian departments, you know, dictatorships, and they vary even to this day at this university. But it was very nice to be in a department that was very democratic and, yep. and welcoming. Okay.
How'd you pick arachnology?
That's an interesting story in itself. I was at college, and after, in my junior year in college, my professor, who recently died, his name was Lincoln Brower, and he said, I have an opportunity for you to spend a summer in Colorado. I'd never been west of Pennsylvania. With a professor there who studies spiders. And I realized that I and my brother were terrified of spiders. I was a real arachnophobe. And so, but it was a great opportunity. It was free, you know, and in the Rocky Mountains, it seemed perfect. So I just, the first spring day, and the winters are pretty harsh in New England, the first spring day I went out and I found a spider on a fence post, a jumping spider, which are nice spiders. And I put it in a vial and I brought it back to my dorm room. I remember this very clearly, though I think I was living in a fraternity that year. And after a few days, I gave it a little water. I took the vial out and let the spider walk across my hand back and forth. And jumping spiders are spiders with good eyesight as opposed to some other spiders. So it could turn and look at you. But I don't remember that. I just remember sweating it, as, you know. And I just said, this is too good an opportunity to let a fear of spiders. And so they've been great. I always say to people, I said, yeah, they've been my business associates and I get along well with them. I still like spiders. And people are fascinated with spiders because they don't really know all that much about them. Mm-hmm. And so that's one aspect. The other aspect is that I then did my graduate work with that professor that I met at, in the Rocky Mountain Biological Laboratory in Gothic, Colorado. Mm-hmm. And there's a great social grouping of arachnologists. There's just not that many of them.
Yeah.
So you know pretty much every arachnologist in the country, and they would have these annual meetings. I take that. The American Arachnological Society was founded soon after, or while I was in graduate school, I guess, and it turned out to have these annual meetings. And annual meetings of arachnologists are very different than annual meetings of microbiologists or something, because the meetings would have about 100 people come, and they'd be at a campus. You'd live in the dorms, it'd be in the summertime usually. Mm-hmm. And so there was a great sense of fraternity or so, friendship there, and it was very quite fascinating. So it was really nice, and I'm trying to remember what year, but by the 1980s, once I was president of the American Arachnological Society, which sounds big, but it's a small group. And so that, it turned out to be a great choice. And, you know, it's it was interesting. Anyway, it gave me great pleasure. And I did research in the tropics, which is just so neat, and all that.
Where did you go?
Well, I did my research in Costa Rica and Panama, and I continued working there, and then I had opportunities to go to Borneo. This is once I got here. And I did publish my dissertation, and I published some other papers. I realize in retrospect that research is not my forte. I'm really a very social person. Even relative to my brother, who's reasonably social too, but I, you know, so I found that that the research was fine, but the subject is fascinating, but I really like to work with people. And so around the late 1980s, I had the opportunity to be associate director of the Honors Program at the University of Florida. And that suddenly came about almost out of the blue, and it was very satisfying as well in a, in a creative world that you would be a social world, dealing with people. As much as lovable as spiders are, the people, I think, are much more interesting. And so I got involved in that for about 10 years, I figure, or so.
And so that's students from across all fields?
All fields. This is just the first 2 years at the University of Florida Honors Program. And so that offered other opportunities. But I love teaching large classes. I taught both undergraduate and then graduate courses. And I like teaching graduate courses. I especially like teaching graduate courses when they were team taught, because I like working with a colleague. So once we gave a course in astronomy, I guess, with Tom Carr, who was Archie Carr's name you may have met, I know, brother, who was a physicist who worked on radio emissions from Jupiter or something to that effect. But we taught a course on life, extraterrestrial life, of which we had not one iota of information now, but it was really a lot of fun to do that. But there were a whole bunch of other things. And I like the big classes. I am much more comfortable talking to 1,000 students than to at a scientific meeting where you talk to your peers
in a
smaller group. And that turned out to be a lot of fun. Started a literary magazine in the Honors Program. It was just kind of a seat of your pants. Since I was not the director, I was the associate director, I had a lot more freedom to interact with students. We had weekly visits to the dorms, and or the residence halls, as they like to call them. And so that was a very satisfying thing. And so so as a result of this, I stayed as associate professor. You really have to have a much better research, and I do truly am not regretful of that, because I was doing things that I enjoyed, though some people would say, "Gee, you never were promoted to full professor," and I'm supposed to regret that, but I haven't. So then DROP came. Now, DROP is a program, it's a dreadful name, called Deferred Retirement Option Plan. And that came about in the late 1990s. It was the legislative idea that state employees, including professors, when they qualified to retire, would have a one-year opportunity to retire, and you were given your retirement benefits for 5 years, as well as you worked for those 5 years. So the retirement benefits went into an escrow, making at the time, this is a turn, this was around 1998, of 6% a year. And even though, even then it was reasonable, now it would be a great return on investment. So we in zoology, there were about five of us who qualified, and we had 1 year to decide this. So we are always a little insecure, we being in the slightly softer sciences. So we went over to the chemistry department and said, what are you doing? And there were nine people qualified, and they said, this, we can see no, nothing, no drawbacks to this. So we all signed up for a job. That was 1998. And I would have to, I guess it was 98, retire in 2003. Well, that turned out to be great. And because you could kind of plan for the future. And the result, I at the time was active in the faculty union, United Faculty of Florida. And I was vice president of the local branch. And the president was elected president of the state, as I remember it, Tom Augster. And so I became president of the faculty union. But considering that I was in drop and all that, I could put a lot of effort into that. Mm-hmm. And for, I think I was president for 2 years, maybe 3 years. I had some great controversies with President Young, who was president of the university at the time. And you know, we were at odds about raises and contracts and things like that. But president of union is a tricky thing because you really can't, you can only speak for the union, and the union is a very democratic structure as well, which means whatever you said, you got a group of people together and say, now what do we do now? Mm-hmm. And so you go, you get someone from the collective bargaining unit to list the demands, then you modify it, and it was a fascinating phenomenon. And so that worked out very well. And then in 2003, I retired. And by then I was fairly active in the Democratic Party, which I had joined the local executive committee. And the Democratic, all the political parties, the two major parties in the state of Florida have executive committees. These, they sound like a small group, but they're really representatives, ideally, from every precinct. We have 60, at the time, 67
counties.
67 counties, but we also had 67 precincts, ironically, in Gainesville. Now we have 63. It all has to do with finding polling places. Okay. In them. But at the time, so I was active, and in 2000, I was elected treasurer of the local Democratic Executive Committee. And that turned out to be great because a treasurer knows everything that's going on, because you're required by law to account for every penny coming in, mm-hmm. every penny going out, and that sort of thing. And
was that difficult? Did you have an accounting or a math background at all, or was that okay for you?
No, it was all right. We had QuickBooks at the time. I don't think they use it anymore, but QuickBooks. And then in the summer of, so I had retired in 2003, in summer of 2004, and this was the Kerry campaign year, the chair of the party stepped down. And so I ran for chair of the party against another person, and I won. And then I served as chair for the next 8 years. So I had to go through that election, then each presidential year there's an election for the leadership. So I was chair from 2004 to 2012. Hmm. Goodyears, et cetera. It was just fascinating. Again, great opportunity to interact with people. And we won some, we lost some, and but very satisfying and surely filled my attention so that there was not a sense at retirement that suddenly nothing to do.
I've
always been active in groups, but when I was at the university, they were the union, but there were a few other things. I started a local branch of Amnesty International back in late 70s, early 80s. I don't remember the year. So I was involved in these issues. And one of the topics here says liberal politics. That's one that I'm going to circle. So that went well. And I tell people this, to chair any group that's a volunteer group, you really have to have a great deal of tolerance. And as I told someone recently, it sounds foolish, but you have to suffer fools gladly. And you suffer fools gladly because those who are interested in political activities have a broad spectrum of participation. Some just want to be a member of something, and others are willing to work their rears off. And in any volunteer organization, there's this whole spectrum. And if you get 20% that are hard workers, you're way ahead of the game, even though the other 80% you bear with. And it wasn't that divided, but it must have been about a third of them that would come to a monthly meeting, and that's about all they did.
Yeah.
And then about maybe a third worked, especially right near election time, you could get them to work through a sense of duty, but also guilt. Guilt makes the world run in many ways. So that was very satisfying. Meanwhile, I've gotten involved with a whole bunch of other organizations that I could make a contribution to. Some, like I was on the board of Planned Parenthood. I was on several things. And I got involved with a group about 10 years ago now. This is 2018, so 2008, maybe a little more than that, but I'm trying to remember the years, maybe 2005 or 6, called the Institute of Learning and Retirement. And this is an interesting group that is is just what it says. It basically offers courses for those in retirement or older citizens, older Americans, just older people who live here, and associated with Oak Hammock. Oak Hammock is a continuous care. Anyway, it's a retirement place where people retire, and it's associated with the University of Florida, and they needed people to teach courses and they basically have 3 semesters in a year of formal courses that are 6 weeks courses open to anybody who wants to take them. And I got involved in the curriculum, which offered me an outlet for my teaching and that sort of thing. And that turned out to be very satisfying as well. And I taught courses on arthropods, not only partly teaching and partly just facilitating, which is probably what I most enjoy, is getting other people to do things. And so that led to now I'm on the board of that organization. Sometimes I get on too many things, but but there are other groups. For instance, one of the boards I'm on now is called the Cotton Club Museum and Cultural Center. I don't know if you've heard about the Cotton Club. There is, I'll just do a quick summary of it. Back in the 1940s at Camp Blanding, there was a military base there, or at least associated with the military. And after the war was over, there were buildings that were no longer used. And an entrepreneur here in Gainesville bought one of the buildings and brought it to Gainesville, piece by piece, put it together in the southeast part of town, in the African-American community, to make a movie theater. It was built as a movie theater. And by the time it was a movie theater, it was 1948. He bought it in 46, and I don't remember the name. I should know. But he built the movie theater. But there were more than one movie theater for African-American community. It was a very segregated town in those days. Mm-hmm. And so it didn't pan out that well. And so by 1950, it was made into a venue for traveling African-American musicians. It's called the Chitlin Circuit, meaning African-American performers, jazz, pop music, that sort of thing, would go from town to town, city to city, mainly performing to the African-American community. And so from 1950 and 51, those 2 years, it was called the Cotton Club. The Cotton Club was named after a famous cotton club in Harlem, New York, which was active in the, I guess, the 1930s and 40s. And here it was, somewhere on 7th, Southeast 7th Avenue, the building. And unfortunately, it was very popular. It was not only popular in the African-American community, it was popular at the University of Florida. And students and faculty came, which informally integrated and a place in town, which was not to the liking of the city fathers. And so they withdrew the permit in 51, I guess. So it was really active as the Cotton Club there. And then it became a juke joint, just playing recorded music thing they called the Blue Note. Blue Note is the name that at least it told. And then by the end of the 50s, it had been abandoned and was used as a storage building for some businesses like Babcock Furniture and things like that. And it was falling in disrepair. And then one of amazing person by the name of Vivian Filer, who is a retired nurse now, said this is a great opportunity to restore it and make it a museum for African-American culture and history of this area. And she started at the idea was in the mid-90s, and then it organized in the first decade of the 21st century into the Cotton Club Museum and Cultural Center, looking for money. And finally, they got a big grant from the state, and we're going to have a ribbon cutting on the 12th of November of this fall, 2018, 11 a.m. Anyway, and I had a good friend who's no longer with us, Polly Doty, who was on the board. I went to one of these gatherings. They were looking for people to participate. And so about 5 years ago, I joined that board. And that has turned out to be a great deal of fun as well. It's all fun,
yeah.
You know, and hopefully it moves the world forward. So that's another thing I'm involved with. Oftentimes I get roped in by people, and my wife is supportive, but she says, you've got to say no sometimes. So the last board that I am, two more activities. Each one has a woman or a man behind it in the sense of twisting arm. Mention two more. There's someone you may or not know by the name of Shirley Bloodworth. She is an active participant in a lot of activities involving older adults. And back at the turn of the century, there was a group of an informal group, which is still informal, called the Community Coalition for Older Adults. It's basically an advocacy group that meets once a month at the Senior Rec Center, now that we have a Senior Rec Center, meets once a month and basically focuses on health, transportation, housing, related and basically issues, including political issues that concern older adults, and which is the largest growing demographic in Florida because of Florida being what it is. And so it was called the Community Coalition for Older Adults. And so Shirley Bloodworth, who's 89, and myself, and Christian Griffith, who is the director of Elder Options, are the co-chairs of this group. And 25 to 30 individuals meet once a month. And they're not all older adults. A lot of them are quite young, but they're involved with health, housing, transportation, the various options that end of life aspects or getting older require, because we haven't quite nailed down immortality, at least not not in one's own body. So that's a group I'm in. And then another group that I'm about to become chair of next year is the Lachua County Library Foundation, which is just a group that raises money and builds an endowment, and then each year a certain proportion of that endowment is spent to enhance the libraries. And so we have an endowment of about $1.2 million, and wow. So that is interesting in itself. So all of these things go on, and then of course.
So pretty quiet retirement is what I'm hearing.
Yeah, not a single day, and right now we're I'm no longer chair of the Democratic Party. In fact, I'm just a precinct man, and got my wife to be a precinct woman, and we have other people, and we're just getting out the vote in precinct 32, and that's the focus from now to election day, except for my trip to Staten Island for my 60th high school reunion. I've only stayed in touch with one person in high school. And she'll be there, and we will see how it goes. What else? So that's a quick synopsis of my life. I like to travel a lot, and so with my wife, and we have fun.
Where'd you meet your wife?
What?
Where'd you meet your wife?
Oh, that's good. In graduate school, it's interesting. She describes better the meeting than I remember it, because I was just coming back from a field trip, 1963. I'd been down in Central America. And she had just gotten a job there in the biological labs at Harvard and with friends. I actually knew her brother before I ever met her, but I didn't meet her. I did not meet her through her brother, but it's a long story. But I came by, and from my field trip in my field clothes, and everybody knew me. And she said, "Who is this person?" And I had my college ring. I used to have a college ring somewhere, and it was turned around, so she thought I was married. So then I had a girlfriend at the time. And my girlfriend had a party, and she invited Julia, that's my wife's name, Julia to the party, and we met at the party. That's when we first met. And then the first date I had, and I was never good at breaking off relationships, so I remember Julia told me that that my girlfriend, whose name escapes me at this moment, said to Julia, said, "I haven't seen John. He hasn't called for a while." So looking back, I said, you know, anyway, these transitions are difficult. But I remember the first date we had. I took her to a play in Boston called The Black Nativity, and it was it was gospel related. It was a really interesting play. But I had just had my physical, this is 1963, my physical for the draft.
Right.
So I couldn't I kept talking about it, and it was amusing in its way, you know, even though when you look back, it you should be terrified, you know, this sort of thing. But as I say, I got, in those days, this is 63, before things really heated up, and I got a deferment. Staten Island is a community of overall lower middle class, and it had enough, it fulfilled its quota without having me, and I was in graduate school, so I kind of missed it. In fact, being born in 1940, I'm not a baby boomer, and I've ridden this wave ahead of the wave. Like, I always think it's like surfing, this wave of population that followed. And so in many ways, I think I was lucky to be born in 40, even though I do.
You're after Korea and before Vietnam.
Yeah, well, I mean, if I figure, I was born in the end of May, and the war began, World War II began around the 1st of September of 39. And I figure that was about the time I was conceived. And can you imagine even thinking about family when the world was just falling apart?
Right.
And it was just a terrifying time. But we were conceived, and then we split early, so that I have his twin brother, and identical twin brother, and which was a very had an enormous impact, I think, on certain choices I made, especially with regard to hobbies and things like that, because my brother and I are good friends, but we avoided competition. We were not very competitive. And in that regard, I wonder if I were a single child, I would have been playing the piano more and doing some other things that he was more enthusiastic about.
Okay.
So we kind of, but anyway, it's a what ifs, you know.
Yeah.
I'm sure a lot of these interviews talk about what if.
Yeah.
Like this opportunity to get involved with spiders, it's given me
serendipity, right?
Yeah, serendipity.
That's how life works.
Hindsight. Anyway, so that's my story. I can dig into any one. I'm ready to answer questions if you have any questions.
I'm interested a little bit more about your brother. Like, how are you and your brother the same? How did you diverge, and what's still the same?
That's interesting. He is quieter a bit. He's autistic. He is gay. But he didn't know that. Well, maybe he did. I don't know. But he got married soon after I got married, and the divorce was initiated by his wife, who he's still quite close to. He went into geology, which I think was really a great move on his part. He went to Princeton University. And Princeton University is a pretty stodgy place. And where I found a sense of community among arachnologists, I think he, at least in college, enjoyed the geology. Geologists have kind of a ritualized summer of their sophomore year where they all go in the field and measure rocks and outcrops, and I think he enjoyed that. And he went to graduate school but didn't finish in his initial graduate school. He got a master's at Yale, and then was kind of footloose for a while, taught at several places, Mount Holyoke College for a while, but he didn't have his PhD, which was unfortunate. So trying to remember the years exactly. But by the time he was in his 30s, he realized he really needed a PhD. So he decided to go back to graduate school. And at the time, he got in the graduate program at the University of North Dakota.
Oh, wow.
In Grand Forks, North Dakota, which gave us, as a family, the opportunity to visit a new state, North Dakota, at the time. And But he was very artistic and musical and that sort of thing, and he got the perfect job. Talk about luck, I think. He got a job in Winston-Salem at the North Carolina School of the Arts, which is now part of the University of North Carolina School of the Arts. And he taught geology and earth sciences, both at the high school and the college level there, because they give bachelor's degrees, and you know, you could have a whole division of theater, whole division of music, but you also had to have general studies because right. people were getting a degree. Mm-hmm. And so he met this composer that they fell in love, and then what year is this? Two, three years ago, they got married in Vermont. I haven't told you about Vermont yet either. We spend our summers in Vermont, and in 1998, I have a colleague who had a cabin up there, who has a cabin over there, and he bragged about it and said how wonderful it was. And in 1998, a cabin near him came on sale, and Julia went up to look at it. I was teaching. I didn't have the time to leave. And she's a research scientist, incidentally, and she had more flexibility. So she went up, and we bought this shack. That's what it was at the time. and the first summer we spent a couple weeks there, 1999, and we've been going every year for the last 20 years. And it's on a very beautiful lake about 5 miles from Canada in northeastern corner of Vermont. So that first summer I was 59, and it was a kind of a very different thing to do, but when you've experienced the summers here, as you have,
absolutely,
you know, and it's turned out to be a real major part of our lives in the sense of escaping, escaping everything. It's off the grid, so there's no electricity. Mm-hmm. We have a phone, which is kind of lucky, a landline, but otherwise we bathe in the lake, and we read, or at least I do, she does too, and it's been wonderful. And then, but after a few years in that shack, we decided we had to do something about it, and then the camp next to us became available, so we bought that camp, and that's where we live, and then we rebuilt the other one over the years, and so it's been wild. And we have two kids, haven't mentioned our children, Michael, who just got tenure at North Carolina State University. He's an entomologist, so not so far from, mm-hmm. works on mosquitoes, which are big topics now. And my daughter, who lives in Boston, in Somerville. I did something around, when they finished college, my son traveled around the world for a year or so, and my daughter got a internship 1 year at the Children's Museum in Boston. And so she settled there and then started working in a bookstore and all that. Around 2000, I think I did one of, I'm most proud of, I said, listen, you really have to have a practical degree that allow you to get a job. And I will fund you to get a master's in a practical field. So my daughter got her master's in library sciences at Simmons, and it has a good program. FSU has a great program in library science, and she became a librarian. And ultimately, she's been working for the last 20 years. So it was a little earlier than that, maybe in late 90s. I did this at. She's a librarian at Harvard University.
Oh, wow.
Which sounds good, but they don't treat their employees all that well.
No.
But she's very good at what she does. And my son, I said, you get pick a field. And he was a biologist already, and he got his master's in public health at University of Michigan, and then went on to get a PhD, et cetera. And even then, I think I may have had to pay a little bit for the first year or so, and then he got grants and scholarships and things like that. So that worked out well. So I'm very proud that I said, I kind of, I'm not usually all that well at planning ahead, but these things worked out well. And so that's good. Now each of them have two children of their own. And my son's family, who they live in Raleigh, his wife, it's a long, this is a much longer story. His wife was made guardian of a child, she had a foster sister, and about 10 years older than Martha. That's my son's name is Michael, his wife is named Martha. And that woman, Charla, adopted a child who was a mixed race child, if in a manner of speaking, because father was Norwegian, the mother was Fijian. Hmm. That's not a combination you right. see every day. Mm-hmm. And then about 2 years, a little over 2 years ago, she got word that Charla had a recurrence of a cancer and was dying, and Martha was the guardian of the child, who was 9 years old at the time,
wow.
a girl. Mm-hmm. My son has and Martha have two sons, younger. So suddenly they became the guardians
of a nine-year-old.
Of a nine-year-old who's now 11 years old.
Wow.
And what a shock that is to a family. So, but they've worked through it, and I think it's working out very well. And then my daughter has two children. Dashiell is a son who's nine, and Julia Rose. And Julia Rose is the seventh in a line of Julias. It goes back to the 1820s in my wife's family. Now, my background... My grandparents, all my grandparents came from Russia. I'm Jewish. I am a secular Jew, meaning I'm not religious. Judaism is interesting because it's both an ethnicity, mm-hmm. it's a religion, it's a combination of a bunch of things that make it very difficult to characterize. My wife was brought up Episcopalian. And but we think about these things exactly the same way, though her parents didn't always think about it that way. So, but it's worked out really quite well. So, what was your question again?
rambling on. No. Family, your brother, family.
Is very artistic. Does a lot of work of art, prints, and that sort of thing. He's musical by ear, plays piano. He is active in the Audubon Society. He was president of the local Audubon Society up in Raleigh, which he didn't especially like.
Oh.
Sort of thing I would love.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying.
Yeah, so we're a little different that way. It's not, opposite is too strong because, when I talk to him, oftentimes we agree on a lot of things. He's just a little more conservative, a little heavier than I am, which is something I don't mention to him. So there is a sense of that. And I was always a little ahead of him, at least in high school, academics and this sort of thing. And you'll have to talk to him sometime.
Right.
But it's just one of those things. Right. And I'm a little more outgoing, a little more social, this sort of thing. And in some ways, I think maybe a little more superficial. I'm generally optimistic. Every so often, there are lots of reasons to be pessimistic in this world. But my nature is more optimism. Neither of my kids are all that optimistic. And I wonder if that has a genetic tendency of something that is involved. But, nature nurture is really interesting. One of the things I did in the Honors Program, now it comes to mind, that was very satisfying. I taught a course, one of the Honors courses, limited to 20 students, on twins.
Huh?
Did it three times. And that was fascinating because you figure out how many twins are on the campus of the university, undergraduates, and there are a lot of them. Just statistically, you know. Right. And I had each student find twins, and there were fraternal twins and identical twins. And if both identical twins went to the University of Florida, they were always together. It was an amazing thing. Mm-hmm. After their freshman year, where they have to live in the residence halls, mm-hmm. at least they used to, I don't know if it's still the mm-hmm. case, then they often roomed together for the next 3 years or 4 years, how many years it took to get out of here.
Sure.
So teaching that was just a lot of fun because it's very eclectic. It involved literature. Shakespeare has a wonderful play on twins. Comedy of Errors. I'm trying to remember the title of it. Anyway, there was literature. There was a lot of biology, which was my
sure.
strength. There's a lot of ethnic. For instance, West Africa has the highest rate of fraternal twinning in the world. Something like 24 of every 1,000 births are twins in Benin and parts of Nigeria, whereas the lowest twinning of fraternal twins is in Japan. About 3 per 1,000.
Wow.
And they think it's diet, or it could be, it has to do with multiple ovulations, as opposed to identical twins, which is still a mystery.
Yeah.
Somehow something interferes with the splitting, and the two, the zygote splits, the ball, of cells split mm-hmm. for some reason. It depends on how late it splits. If it splits really late, you get Siamese twins.
Right.
And that's mm-hmm. that's a real problem. But that was a great course to teach. And the course I teach now, or at least I don't teach it, I facilitate it in the Institute of Learning and Retirement, of which there are some 500 members, but half are from Okamek, but half are townies like myself. I've taught the last 7 years a course on the Nobel Prizes of the previous fall. In October of each year, they announce the Nobel mm-hmm. Prizes, 6 of them. Perfect. Because the course in the ILR are 6-week semesters. And so I was able to get an expert on each of the prizes from the university or from the community. And I got a whole bunch of people talking. And oftentimes there were people who were the students of some of the Nobel laureates. There were some people who roomed with them. You know, in their fields, they knew the stars.
Right.
And that has been a lot of fun. Again, I feel like an impresario rather than teaching it, because I'd be on the phone trying to track down someone who could talk about that subject with some expertise. This last semester, the economic sciences, which is an oxymoron, but the economic sciences prize was won by a guy named Richard Thaler, or Robert Thaler. Anyway, Dr. Thaler, which was on behavioral economics, and I call the people I know, and being at the university, you just dive in and you say, if you won't do it, we will recommend someone who will, and you go down until you find someone.
Right.
Sometimes it works out, sometimes it doesn't. In this case, I realized that our mayor, Lauren Poe, the mayor of Gainesville, teaches economics at Santa Fe College, and he gave a superb presentation on that. So it that's, again, a lot of fun. Sometimes I'll teach, but other times I will.
Yeah.
Anyway, so here it is. Okay, my wife is not back from the gym yet, but we have this luncheon today in
sure.
League of Women Voters, something else I'm active in, which brings me to the last activity, which I'm right involved in now. Part of the CCOA, the Community Coalition of Older Adults, is to give a course on civics for seniors, and I've been involved with this. And again, as a facilitator, I'll give a talk some, but mostly as a facilitator. And I've just organized last summer, I organized 3 sessions the next 3 weeks. So I organized these sessions on advocates, people who are active their whole lives, far more than me. I just tend to, you know, go from one thing to another. But someone like Joe Corder, who founded the Civic Media Center, it's 25th anniversary, I think, is coming up. And then other people, Scott Camille, who's an anti-war activist, Sierra Club person, Jeremiah Tattersall are the 2 speakers next week, and he is a union activist. And then Terry Fleming, who is a leader in the gay community, Pride Center, and also president of the Democratic LGBT and several other initials organization in the state. And then Evelyn Fox, who's the local president of the NAACP. And this kind of facilitating, so much easier. So he sent some bio stuff so I can introduce him tomorrow afternoon. So anyway, and so that's a lot of fun too. So, you know, as long as you keep doing these things, you're distracted from worrying about how your end will come. Yeah. You know? I think being active, trying to see things that actually not only give you satisfaction, but help the community, I think everybody. And it's not necessarily associated with liberal or conservative views. It has to do with helping the society move the way you feel it ought to, and that sort of thing. So.
That is fantastic. Do you have anything, last words or anything? I don't want to make you late for
last
you,
words but. Sounds horrible. No, that's fine. You know, I enjoy talking about myself sometimes. Sure. I don't have that much.
This has been such a treat. Did you have any specific question that you wanted or anything?
I mean, the one thing that I think we're supposed to ask is, do you have any advice for medical professionals about to start their career?
Well, I do completely agree with the move to sit down and listen a lot. And I've had doctors who have listened to me. It's funny. I talk to others who have doctors who say, oh, I just drop them a text and they answer immediately. I'm not sure that's the solution. I think it requires the realization that we all have beginnings and ends, to make life comfortable, not only physically, but mentally. I think that's my advice to physicians. They can't solve all the problems. There is no such thing as immortality. So, you know, they talk about palliative care, and it's not exactly clear what that is. Someone recently, someone at Atlantic Magazine or somebody wrote a column that says, once I turn 75, I don't want any more medical treatments, you know, and that sort of thing. I'm 78. I want to live a quality life. Mm-hmm. And if medical treatments will help, but quality of life, I think, is very important. And I really don't have time to think of mortality. Mm-hmm. And I try to avoid thinking about morbidity.
Yeah.
So, you know, I think the doctor should be part of conspiracy to avoid too much of this, but also just the quality of life is really important. Mm-hmm. And so good luck to both of you.
Thank you.
What is your specialty?
I'm going to go into family medicine.
Good. And so this is
right on my alley.
Do you know where you went to University of Florida?
Yes. Yep.
Gators.
Yep. And I applied to residency program here as well. We'll see how it goes. I've been in Gainesville a long time. Yeah.
Yeah. How old are you?
48. 48.
Yeah. Really? How old are you?
Yeah. I am 26.
I was
That's
a biostatistician.
That's a story in itself. I'm sure we can open it up to, so with some other time.
Sure.
Absolutely. Yeah,
this has been good, such a treat.